Welcome to This Is Money Budget Special. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Helen Crane, with a cameo from pensions guru Sir Steve Webb. And coming up, from a pension shake-up to childcare costs, freezing fuel duty and energy prices, how will the budget affect you? Plus inflation to plummet and no recession this year. Does this mean things are looking up at last? And have we reached the end of the interest rate hikes? Plus, are we heading for a 2008-scale financial crisis? Don't be getting up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, so Simon, Helen, wasn't much in Jeremy Hunt's budget speech, I have to say, in terms of personal finance news that we didn't actually know beforehand. Childcare, pensions allowances, energy bill help. We did get a small pensions bunny out of the cap, I guess you can say, which we'll get to shortly. But perhaps the bigger news is around the financial forecast. So no recession this year, inflation to fall to 2.9% by the end of the year. All good news, right? Well, it would be, except for the fact the OBR is still warning that we face still the worst decline in living standards since records began in the 1950s and the highest tax burden since World War II. Marvellous. Simon, firstly, what did the Chancellor set out to deliver in this speech, this budget, and did he succeed?
Seemingly the exact opposite of what he set out to deliver in November, when his tactic was to be the headmaster who had taken control of the unruly school and was there to scare the bejesus out of us and issue some dire Eeyore-style predictions about how bad everything was going to get and therefore justify all of the tax hikes that he was putting in place. This week, it's quite different. Hmm. It was positively Tiggerish, bouncing around the place with his little jokes and laughs and ha ha ha, we've avoided recession, you know, isn't this great? Everything's absolutely peachy. If you took the tone of this week's speech at face value, except it's not really, is it? Because firstly, you've got to remember he did all those tax hikes last November that we just mentioned, and there's the tax hikes and then there's the fiscal drag as well, hence the highest tax burden. And also the OBR is forecasting that the recession is not going to be as bad as the OBR was forecasting in November. I don't know what was in the water in November, but the OBR was very, very, very pessimistic, presumably just doubling down after being completely ignored in the Kwasi Kwarteng spectacular earlier in the autumn. But it's become much more optimistic now. So we've got a number of things coming into play there. Inflation has started to fall. Interest rates are not expected to go up quite as much as interest rates were expected to. The effect of that on people's mortgages is being, I would argue, downplayed perhaps by official bodies and the Bank of England. I think it's actually probably going to bite a bit harder than they expect. But also energy prices have come down quite substantially, and we need to factor that in quite a bit. And you know, the economy has done that thing that it's done before and it did during COVID, and it's actually displayed a remarkable degree of resilience in the face of all this stuff. Consumer spending isn't that bad. I think it's being held up largely by quite a lot of people either being considerably wealthier than others and so therefore not feeling the pinch anywhere near as badly, and then unfortunately by people further down the scale, maybe living a bit on the credit cards and stuff like that, is what the figures appear to indicate. But, you know, the good news is that it doesn't look anywhere near as bad as it did in November when, let's face it, the forecasts were absolutely dire.
I've asked you this before, Simon, but briefly, what's the point in forecasts if they're always wrong?
It is to give journalists something to write about, and podcasters something to talk about. Mm-hmm. And then everyone can say, ha, look, they got it wrong again, whilst conveniently ignoring any forecasts they that made themselves, which were also completely incorrect.
Excellent. Good to know. Good to know. Helen, a budget for growth. Healthy growth, though. Healthy growth. Back to work budget. Lots of ease in there. We'll get to the policies in more detail, but what caught your...
Are you thinking that was why Jeremy Hunt was looking so chipper? all those E's.
I don't know what you're talking about there, Simon. Helen, we'll get to that, as I said, the policy in more detail, but what caught your ear?
Yeah, you're right. So the theme was very much everyone get back to work, you know, boost productivity. That was very much the tone of it. You're right to say that most of the things that came out have been trailed before, which seems to be the way that these sort of things work now. The little surprise that was in there was this pension announcement. So scrapping of the lifetime allowance, which went further than people had expected. So there's now no limit on how much people can save into their pension before they get taxed on it when they withdraw it. So it's a big boost for sort of wealthy pension savers. The other thing that caught my eye was the sort of expansion of free childcare hours, which again is a move to get people back into work, namely people who might not be working at the moment because it doesn't work out because of the cost of childcare. So yeah, very much everyone get your lazy bums back to work was very much the overarching tone, which I mean in a way possibly slightly patronizing. Is anyone who isn't in work and doesn't want to be gonna go back because Jeremy Hunt tells them to? I mean, you know, some of these announcements they'll work for certain kinds of people, particularly people who are kind of earning more on the pension stuff. But yeah, very much productivity focused and get back to work focused, I think, was the message for me.
Well, we'll get Sir Steve Webb's view on pensions. Simon, one weird thing that sort of stood out for me, and I'm not the only one to have mentioned this, but the prize fund, the £1 million prize fund for an AI, you're thinking, why on earth is she talking about this? But it sort of represents a wider issue for me. So the government offering a £1 million prize for an AI innovation, but does the free market not exist anymore? Because surely if you've got a great AI idea, the market will do the business and that will be absolutely... I'm completely lost by that. And I just think it's a representative of very big state, high tax. This is not a small state Conservative government, is it?
I like to think that there were lots of people who suddenly flocked to ChatGPT and typed in, ChatGPT, come up with a £1 million prize winning AI idea for me immediately after that. And that Jeremy Hunt will now be inundated with £1 million prize winning ideas that have actually been written by AI. And then he'll have to spend ages sitting there sifting through them, trying to work out what on earth he's doing. I would imagine that if you were the kind of person who had written the kind of AI application that's potentially going to win this prize, that you'd be looking at a much bigger prize than £1 million. But hey, look, £1 million is still £1 million. And that's a lot of money. I guess maybe the question would be whether you would be better off forward funding this stuff rather than getting everybody to do the work and then just saying, all right, you've done it. You've got the Manchester Prize.
It's more big state though. Why do the government feel that they need to even do this sort of intervention? Why do the government feel that they need to have some sort of prize to get people doing this? Like, back off almost.
Maybe just Jeremy Hunt felt that he just needed to mention AI somewhere in there, or wonks in the Treasury said, you need to mention AI. That's the future. We're going to be a high tech economy. You need to mention AI. And he said, well, how much is it going to cost me? And they went, £1 million for a prize. And he went, OK, not my money.
Yeah, do you know, I actually think that's probably not a bad suggestion there, Simon, as to what really happened. Right, we have Sir Steve Webb here. So we are, of course, going to be talking about the pensions element of the budget. So we didn't really get any proper rabbits out of the hat moment, but I guess there was a little ooh related to pensions. Helen mentioned it there. So we know that we knew beforehand that three allowances would go up, the lifetime, or we thought we knew, the annual and the money purchase allowances, but we didn't know the lifetime would be scrapped. If you are still a bit baffled by all of these terms, don't worry. Sir Steve will explain. So firstly, Pensions 101. Welcome, Steve. Thank you very much for coming back on. What are these allowances that I'm talking about? Why are they in place at all?
Well, when you put money in a pension, you get a tax break. And the simplest way of thinking about it is if you earn £100 and you pay basic rate tax of £20 on that, you take home 80. But if you put the 80 into a pension, the government gives you the 20 back into your pension. So you end up with 100 in your pension. That's how tax relief works. And obviously, if you pay at 40% or 45%, it's a bigger leg up. So higher earners benefit more and they've got more money. So they shovel more money in, so they get more top up. So the tax relief system is geared towards high earners. And to try and avoid people, to use a technical term, filling their boots too much, there are limits. So there is an annual limit, which in a standard year is £40,000. So this year, an average person, now, not many of us have got £40,000 to spare, but it's either £40,000 going in from you and your employer, or if you're in a public sector defined benefit type scheme, it's £40,000 worth of pension rights, which is slightly different. And a lot of this is to do with defined benefit pensions. So there's an annual limit, there is a lifetime limit. So the pot you can build up just over £1 million. Once you go beyond that, it's not illegal, but you face a tax charge if you go beyond that. And then there's just an extra little complexity, which is once you've started tapping into a pension post 55, if you then start to build up a pension again, the government says, oh, hang on, you've taken some money out, you've had some tax-free cash, now you're putting it back in again with tax relief, then you'll take it out with tax-free cash. We don't like the sound of that. So they limit what you can do to 4,000, and that's the money purchase annual allowance. So that's what they are, and that's why we have them.
Well explained there. You said that it's not illegal, but there's a bit of a penalty. How much are you talking about? Why would this put people off going over it?
So basically what these charges do is they wipe out the tax break you've had from saving in a pension. So if you reach retirement and you've, let's say it is literally a pot just over £1 million, so you're bumping up against the limit, anything above that limit, if you take it out as a lump sum, they charge 55%, and that's it. That's all your tax satisfied. So if you were going to pay 40% tax anyway and have some tax-free cash, it sort of wipes out the tax benefit of saving in a pension. So 55% for a lump sum, 25% as soon as you retire for a defined benefit pension. So a doctor, for example, who's got a 60,000 a year pension would get a fat tax bill at retirement, a lifetime allowance charge. The scheme would actually pay it for the doctor, and then they'd knock something off the doctor's pension for the rest of his or her life. So that's the lifetime allowance. The annual allowance is if you go over this 40,000, that's just treated as taxable income. So anything above that is taxed at your tax rate. So it is essentially, it sort of feels a bit penal, but what it's really doing is kind of clawing back the tax break that they don't think you should have had.
So what was announced in the budget and why?
Well, there's been a particular issue about the doctors. So doctors have had this strange combination of quirks in the NHS pension scheme, which sometimes meant they were treated as if their pension value had gone up when it hadn't really. One for another session, I think, but that was an issue. They could have a promotion and suddenly the whole value of all their years in the NHS were being applied to this new salary. So it's like a thwonking great input into their pension in 1 year, crashing through all the limits, giving them a tax bill now. And the value of their lifetime pension could go over the limit. So not only were they getting an unexpected bill now, they were heading in retirement for another one when they retired. And doctors, not surprisingly, said, well, blow this, I could be on the famous golf course. So there was a worry about doctors retiring. I think it was a real one. I mean, I'm being slightly flippant, but it was a real one. The debate really is, could the Chancellor have just fixed the doctors? Or could he do what he actually did, which was kind of give everybody affected by any of these issues quite a nice bung?
Simon?
So, Steve, is that why there's a scenario where doctors can't just say, I don't want to put any more into my pension? Because that's what a lot of people, I think is, well, why can't the doctors just opt out of the pension scheme from now? Is it because they just don't know what's going to then happen to them and they're suddenly going to get this massive tax bill?
There's certainly an unpredictability because it's so complicated. I mean, there are financial advisors who just specialise in doctors' pensions because it is really obscure. If you opt out, you are throwing away the equivalent of 20% of your pay because the employer contribution is worth roughly 20% of your pay. So, yes, the doctor could have opted out, but neither you nor I would willingly say, well, because of a quirk of the tax system, I'm going to throw 20% of my pay packet or my package away.
And they won't get that just given to them in lieu, in cash.
Well,
instead.
There's been some debate about could trust pay it in lieu, and would they pay national insurance if they paid it in lieu and all that sort of stuff. And to be honest, doctors, I think, have been spending far too long in the last few years wrestling with all this stuff rather than reading textbooks and curing people. I mean, it really has absorbed a lot of their mental energy.
So, I mean, obviously, doctors, vastly important. We need to get people back to work, and getting doctors working will help other people get back to work. But I mean, how many people do these policies, these three allowances that we talk about, actually impact people?
It's not, I mean, clearly it is the relatively well off. And the two groups really are people with big company pensions or public sector pensions. So senior civil servants, senior teachers, senior doctors, people who run big companies. It's that sort of group of people in the economy. Not many people are literally already over the lifetime allowance, maybe 300,000, something like that. So that's people who are in work and you can already see they've breached the limit. They don't pay the bill till they retire, but you can see they've already got there, as it were. But probably another 1.25 million heading that way. So maybe they're under now, but they've got a pot of money which will be invested and grow and go over the limit, that sort of thing. So maybe 1.5 to 2 million. Nobody knows for sure. The government doesn't appear to have known this week either, but it's that sort of scale. So what they did, I didn't actually say what they did. I think you may have covered it, but is they took the annual allowance up from 40 to 60. The lifetime one went altogether from the 6th of April. The money purchase one went up from 4 to 10. And the one for the really, really rich, because they don't get 40,000, they get what's called tapering down to a very low figure, which was 4,000, and that's gone up to 10 as well. So the very highest earners can now put 10K a year into a pension instead of four.
I was on air talking about this after the budget, got a message straight away afterwards saying, what's the point? Labour are just going to come in and overturn it. And lo and behold, the next day they announced that's what they would do.
And the behavioural response to all of this, I think, is very interesting, because if I thought that the government was going to change in 18 months' time, one option is I fill my boots. So I say, right, well, I'm going to do all this stuff before, you know, in the period, in the window when they abolish the charge. So I'm a doctor on 60,000 a year. That crashes through the limit. I'm going to retire the day before the next general election, take my 60,000 a year pension. New government comes in, probably can't touch me. It would be pretty shocking if they said, well, you know, you knew what we were going to do and you knew we were going to win the election. Here's a tax bill kind of thing. So you could well see, I think, you know, I've talked about a possible gold rush here. Lots of people shoveling money into the pension when the restrictions are lax and then trying to get it out again before the tax man can get his hand on it. And there's a lot of involved financial planning going to happen. I mean, the financial advisors of Britain are going to be busy for the next few months.
I bet they are. I mean, give me some figures. How much could a high earner actually manage to shove into a pension, seeing as the annual allowance and the taper exists?
So in theory, the very, very highest earners are only putting 10,000 a year in, but they raise the threshold at which the tapering starts. In other words, you have to be an even more high earner to be fully wiped out. But of course, you can bring forward from previous years up to 3 years, and that's crucial, because there's a bunch of people who have not been doing any pension saving for years. Perhaps they locked into an old lifetime allowance, say 1.5 million or something, and since then they've done no saving at all to protect that 1.5 million. Well, from the 6th of April, that's gone. So they can suddenly use years' worth of historic unused annual allowance, bring forward up to 40K for up to 3 years plus this year's. So, you know, 6th of April, that's what? Three lots of 40, 120 plus 60, 180,000 if they've got it and they're earning that. You know, it could be huge amounts of money for some people.
A couple of other issues about pensions that we actually didn't hear anything about was, so no word about the state pension rise. Some had been expecting that maybe coming. And also some had been hoping that auto enrolment figures might go up.
Yeah, the state pension, we will get an announcement probably in the next couple of months, we think, on the pension age, state pension age. And we know it's going up to 67 by 2028. The dilemma is when it's going to go to 68. And my guess would be, I mean, I think a few weeks ago, the government still hadn't made their mind up. My guess would be they'll say, well, the politics of this is horrible. You know, you do something tough just before an election. And again, the opposition say, well, we wouldn't. So it's, you know, it's a vote loser. You don't get any money for a decade if you're the Treasury. So I think they'll probably fudge it, say, oh, COVID, ooh, not sure what's happening to life expectancies. We'll come back in 2 years, would be my guess, but I don't know. But on auto enrolment, I mean, the good news is that for about 5 or 6 years, we've been waiting for the government to implement the next stage of auto enrolment. And the big change would be, instead of paying this 8% that we all have to pay above 6,000 or so a year, above a floor, that 8% would apply from the very first pound you earn. So you wouldn't be enrolled until you'd earn 10,000 still, that wouldn't change. But when you were enrolled, it'd be 8% of everything. And if you're a low earner, that could double the amount that's going in. And the good news is the government has now said, yeah, we're committed to this. We're going to let some legislation go through to pave the way. It'd be a couple of years before it happens, but you know, it's been stuck and at last that's starting to move. So, you know, small steps in the right direction.
Would you have got rid of the lifetime allowance, or would you have raised it, or would you have left it where it was, given a free rein?
Yeah, I would have done two things. So I would have fixed the doctors separately. I think there was a, you know, the doctors themselves say, look, the judges have got a separate scheme. You know, there's a very particular arrangement for judges. In principle, there could have been a separate range for top doctors. So I think I would have done the top doctors separately, and I'd have done it 4 years ago. Because one of the government's arguments is, oh, we can't do something clever for the top doctors. It would take too long. Well, yeah, it might, but it wouldn't have done if you'd started 4 years ago. You know, so I think that's quite poor. Would I increase it? I probably would have increased it on the basis that people plan for the long term for pensions. And if you just keep messing around and cutting and slicing, nobody knows where they stand. So I think probably raising it to closer to the sort of level people were expecting when they made their pension plans. You know, I don't know what that number is, but I think I certainly wouldn't have used inflation to erode it. So it's been frozen and we've had 10% inflation. So it's really been cut by stealth. And I think that's just, you know, so at the very least, you should link it to inflation and then decide the right level.
Yeah, because I think my view on the lifetime allowance is that we don't really need it because we have the annual allowance, which does severely limit the amount that high earners, you know, really, really high earners can put into their pensions. And also that when it was brought in, it was at 1.5 million and then it got up to 1.8 million. And then it's been cut repeatedly, you know, all the way down to 1 million at one point. And at the point before it was abolished the other day, it was at just under 1.1 million. And that's, you know, if you take someone who keeps their pension invested and draws 4% a year, that's £43,000 a year. Now, that's a lot of money to be taking, you know, in your pension, but it's not super, super amounts. And, you know, there's a generation now that are retired, who retired on final salary schemes, who could quite reasonably have expected to get 2/3 of their final salary in retirement. So that's the equivalent of somebody retiring on 60 grand and getting, you know, their £40,000 pension. And that's not super, super rich. This is being painted as a bung for the really, really wealthy. That's not really, really wealthy people. That's people doing pretty well in life. And also, I think my problem with it is that the way that it had been cut over the years to such a low level is people just think, well, I'll never be able to get £1 million in my pension. So they don't think it concerns them. But I think it's a tax on aspiration, because if you're earning, if say you're a 45-year-old man and you earn £60,000 now, if you had 15%, if you'd been saving into your pension, like you've been told to since you're in your early 20s, you could conceivably have £200,000 in your pension pot. If you were paying 15%, 10% yourself into your pension, your employer was paying 5% in, and then you were getting the tax relief, you'd have £1,050 going into your pension every month. And if you did that for the next 20 years until you were 65, and you got 6% investment return, which is reasonable, you'd breached your lifetime allowance. You'd be at 1.15 million. And that's, you know, that's the person on 60 grand who might be hoping for 40. Kind of thing. And if someone, if that same person was a 45-year-old woman on £80,000 and she was putting in a similar amount, she'd have £1,400 a month going into her pension and she'd hit 1.3 million. And I think that kind of thing illustrates how, you know, yes, most people will never ever manage to have that much money in their pension, but there are lots of people doing, you know, well-paid, you know, middle-class jobs. They're not middle earners. Middle earners earn much less than that. But, you know, who would have breached this level? So I do think that it needed to go up substantially and then at least start rating it up with inflation or something, because it's been doing the opposite, hasn't it?
It has. And I would agree that a limit that penalises good investment performance is a very odd thing. You know, it's a limit on outcome. It's the size of your pot, essentially. So if you invest better than somebody else and your pot grows faster, you're more likely to hit a tax charge. And that seems a very, very odd thing to do. I mean, I guess, as you hinted in what you just said, this is the relatively wealthy in the pension sense of that word. So I mentioned 1.5 to 2 million. That's what, 5% or so of the workforce. Those are the people who probably have a lifetime allowance issue. So they are the well pensioned compared with most people. But it doesn't mean that they've been millionaires, you know, living in mansions kind of thing. You know, so I think some sensible limit that's not stealthily eroded by inflation ideally doesn't penalise investment growth, you know, so you could have a lifetime contribution limit, for example, rather than a lifetime outcome limit. Trouble is, we haven't got records for the last 40 years of what people have been putting in. So you'd have to phase it in over 50 years, which might be unreasonable. So, yeah, so I think it's ripe for reform. And, you know, for the next couple of years, we probably won't have one.
Thank you very much, Steve. Excellent, as always. Helen, So the aim, I guess, we'll get keep doctors in work, absolutely. But a lot of this speech, a lot of the budget was to get, or the focus was to get over 50s particularly, we've heard a lot about this, into the workplace or staying in the workplace. Why is the Chancellor focusing on this group?
So over the last year or so, really since the end of the pandemic, there's been a lot of talk about economic inactivity. So people who are economically inactive, they're people that essentially could be working. You know, there's no reason that they can't work, but they're not working. They're also not claiming benefits. They're basically just people that have decided that they want to stop work before retirement age. That number has gone up quite a lot since the end of the pandemic. I think, you know, the theory is that a lot of people just kind of thought, you know, they've maybe got used to working from home, or they've perhaps lost their job during the pandemic and thought, actually, I don't know if I want to go back into a kind of full-time working lifestyle or even working at all. And especially people who are lucky enough to maybe save quite a lot during the pandemic, maybe they thought, you know, I'll give it work a few years earlier than I maybe planned. And when that happens in significant numbers, that does have a knock-on effect on things like how easy companies find it to find staff. So we're hearing at the moment that there's a lot of vacancies, there's a lot of jobs that companies are sort of struggling to fill. And that's in part due to these people who could be working but aren't working. So I think the Chancellor's idea is to give these kind of people incentives to get them back to work and fill some of those vacancies that companies are struggling to do. One of the things he mentioned was these midlife MOTs and his returnerships, I think was the word that he used. So his idea is getting people back into work, but giving older people maybe training to do a different job from the job that they did before, which is, I mean, in a way, a nice idea. But are you really going to get people who've kind of decided that that's it for them work-wise say, oh, yeah, no, actually, I'll go and do an apprenticeship and I'll go and work in a tech company? I mean, it's a nice idea, but how many people are actually going to want to do that? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and then get the pay of a new starter at the age of 55 and probably the same amount of respect. Yeah, I think if you've already calculated the fact that you can afford to retire on whatever you've retired on, the chances of you coming back, unless you are just really bored, I mean, I can't think that that's going to work. But, you know, Simon?
I think quite a lot of this conversation is fundamentally missing the point about why some people aren't working. For a start, there's a lot of people who aren't not working due to choice. They're not working due to health.
Oh, absolutely. 2.5 million.
There's a huge element of this there. And just because they're not claiming sickness benefits doesn't mean that they're not working because of ill health. And the impact of COVID and lockdowns on delaying people's treatment and seeing doctors and all these other things, the aggregate effect of that is quite large. And then also, I think there's quite a lot of people not working because if you want to lure people back into work, then you need to give them a more tempting workplace, perhaps. I think they're choosing to not work because they didn't like their jobs and they don't see anything really having changed that would make the difference. And I think I've talked about this before in terms of leveling up, but I think we missed a huge opportunity to try to capitalize on things like hybrid working. I think it's really important for people to be in the office, creativity, communication, all those kinds of things. Does it need to be all the time? Arguably not for many people. For some people it does. And there are many people who don't work in offices who don't have any choice but to go to work. So, you know, don't be moaning too much about that. But there was an opportunity there to try to capitalize on this. And if you want to try to get to the over 50s back into work, do they want to be dragging themselves in every day? Or maybe if you said to them, well, I'll tell you what, come back to work and one day a week, do three, you know, come back 3 days a week and one day you come in and the other two, we can be a bit more flexible. You do it from home or you come in if you want. And then to go back to that also, I think we need to do a lot more promoting of part-time work. Work, we have this, still this kind of Victorian work ethic depicted wonderfully by the fact that we didn't try to take advantage of hybrid working. Instead, we had Jacob Rees-Mogg wandering around leaving notes on people's desks.
Yeah.
But this part-time work, if you're someone in their over 50s who's stopped work and you've got the financial cushion to rely on, but you're thinking, well, maybe, you know what, I'll listen to Mr. Hunt and I might consider going back. You're probably not going to want to go back full time. You're probably going to want to go back part time. But what's going to happen? You're going to get called a part timer, aren't you? People don't consider part time work to be as good. It's inferior. And we need to totally get over that, because we're in a different scenario now to the one we used to be in. And frankly, also, you know, companies don't look after people in the way that they used to. So it's no surprise that people would prefer to just do part-time work in many instances. And we need to, you know, be really talking about that, going, look, this is a great thing. If people could do some work, that's amazing. Have some leisure time, have some work, spend some time looking after their grandchildren, which is what a lot of over 50s are doing.
Exactly.
And things like that. But there's none of, where's that stuff? Where's the looking at what people want to do and people's lifestyles and why they might not be doing this? It's still, and I think Jeremy Hunt did try a bit here in the budget to get a little bit into that, but it's still very much, as Helen said at the top of the podcast, right, get your lazy bums off the sofa and back to work. You know, and like it's been talked about, this whole like get off the golf course kind of thing. They're not all on the golf course.
Yeah, it is a bit strange, that sort of narrative that came up. I'm not sure that that's quite right. And I did like the fact that you mentioned there about grandparents looking after grandkids. So therefore, the Chancellor took a look at childcare, which is where we're going next. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North-Vitoro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, not quite the quiet week on the markets that we were looking for.
Wow, what a week. If ever a five-day period felt like a month, it was this one. However, if you missed the week for whatever reason and just looked at the main equity markets in America or some of the FX markets, it actually doesn't really look like that much has happened. Of course, there's been so much that has gone on. I mean, there were times when markets were under considerable pressure, but the Federal Reserve have stepped in with some high US bank support. Big tech has actually had a pretty good week too, helped by the lower bond yields as well, which has led to strong NASDAQ outperformance. However, in Europe, it's a different story. The DAX and the FTSE have been down heavily. The ECB raised rates by 50 basis points, was expected. US inflation also this week came in line pretty much too. But in reality, this week has all been about the bank contagion spread from the US over to Europe. European stocks had the worst day of the year on Wednesday, and there were many US banks which have been down or up double-digit percentages in the morning or afternoon trade. Of course, most of them finishing way down this week. Markets hate uncertainty, and whilst I don't think it is a big panic, I do understand why we have seen the moves we're seeing.
And after that dramatic week, what do we have to look forward to next week?
Yep, next week, let's deal with the scheduled macro events first. On Wednesday, we've got the latest FOMC meeting and rate decision. On the same day, we also have the latest UK inflation number, which of course will be interesting. Thursday, we've got rate decisions from the Bank of England, the Swiss National Bank and the Norges Bank too, as well as Japanese inflation numbers. We wrap up on Friday with UK retail sales and global PMI numbers. So an incredibly busy week, let alone with everything else that's going on. The week that follows is a lot more quiet, which I think we all need. Other than everything else going on, it's going to be so interesting to see what the Fed do and say. Will they raise rates? Will they lower rates? Or will they keep rates the same? Honestly, I don't know right now, but if pushed, I would say they raise rates by 25 basis points. But who even knows what tomorrow holds at the moment?
Welcome back. So the other big talking point of the budget, and as I mentioned just earlier, finally some help for parents and grandparents, I guess. The Chancellor announced free childcare for all children from 9 months old as part of the government's drive to get people back into work, plus extra funding for providers. Before we get to the nitty gritty from Helen, Simon, as the only one here with children, how bad is the state of childcare in this country?
Do not get me started on
this. Up, Helen.
Really bad. Really, really, really bad. And anybody listening to this who works in childcare, I'm not talking about you personally and holding you responsible. It is the system that is an absolute mess. Firstly, it is unfeasibly expensive. We have some of the most expensive childcare in Europe. And people find it mystifying as to how it can possibly be so expensive.
How we got to that stage.
Okay, so let's go back to when my children were preschool and they were at nursery. So I didn't get 30 hours free childcare. My children are too old for that. But before we even get onto the 15 hours free childcare thing, which, and I'll explain why you don't really get 15 hours, okay? Let's go back to the cost. My children were at a nursery in Finsbury Park in North London. It was not a particularly posh or fancy nursery. It was just your bulk standard nursery. If you worked out what the fees amounted to annually, it was about, at the time, £15,000 a year. It would have been cheaper to send my children to private school than to the nursery, which is totally bonkers. Even when we had the 15 hours free, somehow my daughter was only going one or two days a week, yet we were still paying an unbelievable amount of money, because the 15 hours free doesn't cover the wraparound hours at the end and then the meals and some other things, because the government doesn't really give the nurseries enough money to actually cover all this free childcare that they're promising people. So the nurseries then have to try to claw the money back somewhere. And somehow we were still spending an unbelievable amount of money, even though my daughter was only there 2 days. And once you divide 2 days, 15 hours by two, you get to 7.5 hours a day. And I was like, I mean, isn't that all pretty much meant to be free? So, yeah, it's completely mad. And also, to just put a sort of international perspective on it, my cousin lives in the French Alps with her husband, who's French, and their three-year-old daughter. She told me that they have the daughter in nursery a few days a week because they might as well. It doesn't really cost them that much. I can't remember exactly how much she told me, but it was something like 30 euros a day. The French Alps are one of the most unfeasibly expensive places on the planet. Yet you can have your child in nursery there for absolute pennies compared to in the UK. So it comes as no surprise that for many working parents with preschool children, for one of them, there is no point going out to work, because if they were working full time, then the cost of childcare would actually outweigh the amount of money that they were getting in from their employment. The break-even point of going to work is really quite high for quite a lot of people.
Helen, and that's it, isn't it? Simon says they're one of the parents. Let's be honest, it's mostly the mothers. My sister was in exactly this situation. She is a qualified lawyer. It was actually better for her not to go to work rather than pay all the nursery fees, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what she did for a few years. And then when she returned, she didn't return back as a full lawyer. So I mean, I think it's a shame that you've got a lot of people leaving for a long period of time, but also some of them just never return back to the workplace. And it is largely women.
Yeah, exactly. And I have friends in the same position as well who've had their first children in the last couple of years. And you're right, it is in all these cases, it's the mum. They've either stopped working, they've started working part-time instead of full-time, so they can still look after their kids a couple of days a week, or some of them have taken basically changed jobs and gone into a job that's way below the kind of thing that they're qualified for, because it means they can get a job that actually fits around their need to be at home at certain times and look after their children. It's bonkers, and I think it's a real shame that, you know, a lot of my friends that have done this are really, you know, smart, qualified women, and they just purely for financial reasons, they've essentially just given up. And it's a real shame.
So what's been announced?
So, and the way it stands at the moment, there's no free childcare for any child in England under the age of two. As it stands, you can get 15 hours a week free childcare if your child's under two, if you receive certain benefits. But for most people, that doesn't happen. At the minute, families of all 3 and 4 year olds get 15 hours of free childcare a week over 38 weeks. And you can also get 30 hours a week if your parents earn the equivalent of 16 hours a week at the minimum wage. So what's going to change is there's now, so this is all kind of tapered in, so it's not going to come in straight away. government's going to offer 30 hours a week of free childcare to all children from the age of 9 months by 2025. And that's on top of the existing free nursery hours for children aged 3 and 4. So these are being phased in over the next 5 years, which is supposed to prevent nurseries from being kind of overwhelmed by this demand. So essentially, it opens it up to more families, and in particular, families who are earning more can now get their children free childcare when they're under 3, which they weren't really able to do before. So it's essentially, it's a boost for kind of middle class young families, potentially. However, as Simon said, these free hours don't cover a lot of these add-on fees for things like, you know, hours outside of the kind of regular working hours and meals and all the other kind of things that you have to pay for. So already some parents are saying that even though they've got these free hours, their childcare costs are still going to be really high.
Also, I mean, the government did say that they would spend some millions, I think it was 200 million, perhaps more, hopefully more, because on providers. But it does make you think, is that going to be anywhere near enough if they can't even offer the free childcare places that we need now? I mean, you're hearing about providers saying that they can't even afford to keep open.
Yeah, exactly. And what you have to think of as well, I think, is that, you know, nurseries are businesses and they're dealing with all the kind of pressures that many other small businesses are dealing with at the moment. So, you know, high energy bills, the cost of things like food. So, you know, they're dealing with all those kind of higher business costs as well. So is this extra funding that the government's going to provide to them going to be enough? I mean, quite possibly not.
Simon?
I mean, on past form, you would not be betting on it being enough, would you? We've got a slight problem, I think, in Britain. Well, we've got two problems. One, we don't actually have enough money to pay for the stuff that we're doing anyway when we're not even doing it properly. But two, we've got a slight attitude problem where we can't seem to properly commit to subsidising things that we see as a public benefit in a way that makes them actually usable by the general public in the way that would give the maximum benefit. So childcare is a classic example. If you don't have children, you're probably going, hang on a minute, paying loads of money in tax, all of my costs are going up, I don't have any children, why am I paying for your children to go to nursery? Fair comment.
I don't have children. And can I just say, I think this is one of the most important proposals. Maybe it's because I'm a woman and ever so slightly feminist on this one. But I do think that actually, if you want to get people back to work, if you want productivity, if you want the best people in jobs, then for goodness sakes, you know, and also these are the kids that are going to pay for your pensions. So shh.
There you go. Just said the rest of what I was going to say.
Pretty Simon. Much.
No, but the benefit is that it gets people to work. And actually, if you look at it, the benefit of that person going to work today in terms of productivity and boosting productivity and boosting GDP and all those things outweighs the cost of paying for that child to go to nursery. And if you want to be really, you know, mathematical about it, you just look at those two numbers and go, OK, well, which one's going to get us more? And it's the person going out to work and doing the job that they are qualified to do and the best job they possibly can and not worrying about their kids. That's why you subsidise the nursery place. So there is a productivity argument there. And we need to do something about our productivity because we are gradually becoming a poorer country. If you look at the exchange rate, for example, against the dollar or the euro, we have become poorer by comparison to the US and to the major European countries. And then if you look at the cost of stuff, and then if you look at our wages and all those other things, we have been gradually becoming a poorer country. And we probably need to start looking at some things like this. It's like the whole thing about rail fares. Why should I be subsidising somebody else's railfare is the comment that comes into it. It's like, well, look, this is seen as public good. We need to get people off the roads. That's why we've subsidised public transport. So that's why you need to not have people paying £30 a day to get to travel 25 minutes to work, which is a scenario that happens to people who live just outside London. That's what we need to do. But then we also need to look at some of these things in here where there are examples of stuff that massively skew the system and there are really unfair bits where we just seem to think it's okay to treat some people very unfairly simply because they are higher earners. And there is a catch in this, which is that if one partner earns more than £100,000 a year, you get no free hours. The 30 hours vanishes. Okay. Now, £100,000 a year is a lot of money. and those people are earning a lot of money, but they're probably doing a job that adds quite a lot of value to the economy. And this creates this totally mad element whereby, according to the IFS, the distortions are so severe that a parent with a one-year-old and a three-year-old whose childcare provider charges England's average hourly rate for 40 hours per week would, after these reforms, find that their disposable income falls by £14,500 if their pre-tax pay crosses £100,000. Mm. So if you earn an extra pound, disposable income would not recover its previous level until pre-tax pay reached £134,500, meaning a parent earning £130,000 would be worse off than one earning £99,000. Now, that is completely bonkers, right? Particularly as that person earning £100,000 also starts having their personal allowance taken away from them. So they're effectively paying 60% tax yeah. on that next pound anyway. It is not conceivable that the Chancellor and the members of the Treasury who designed this system are unaware of this. So they have signed off something that involves something like that happening. That's just totally mad. That's no way to run a tax system. You just don't do things like that. It's like the child benefit charge further down the scale. It's like, why do they sign this stuff off that is so patently unfair for people? And to bang a drum I've banged before, okay, look, these people are earning loads of money. It's very difficult to feel any pity for them. But the reason why you need to treat people fairly as they rise through the tax system is that you want them to continue paying their taxes and feeling good about it, because that person's probably going to go on to earn more money. So just, you know, just try and keep them a little bit sweet rather than absolutely hammering them in a totally crazy way.
Here, here, Simon, here, here. Right, Helen, just briefly, we're going to go through some of the other measures. So energy price guarantee.
Yeah, so that's good news for households. So the average household energy bill, the level of this energy price guarantee, which the government has put in place to essentially cap people's energy bills, that's going to stay at £2,500 a year now until July. So that's based on a household with average usage. It had been due to go up to £3,000 a year in, I think, April, but that's now not happening. So until July, energy bills essentially capped at £2,500 a year. That essentially, I think, is an attempt from the government to kind of get us over the sort of energy bill hump of this winter. And they're hoping that, you know, obviously energy bills will go down when the summer comes around. And then by next winter, I think they're hoping that energy bills will have reduced substantially. So we're seeing the wholesale cost of energy going down. That does take a while to translate into people's bills, but hopefully by the time we get to next winter, energy bills will have gone down quite a bit. Nowhere near as much as where they were a couple of years ago, but some of the pressure they think will have been taken off.
Also, fuel duty, that's being frozen for the 13th year, isn't it? And also the 5p reduction that we got last year, that's staying for another 12 months. Am I right, Simon?
That is correct. Fuel duty is frozen again. The 5p is staying. Fuel duty still represents a very large amount of the cost of a litre of petrol, as does the VAT charged on it. But, you know, that's good news for motorists. You probably don't want to be hitting them for a load more in the pocket. And lots of people are shifting to electric cars anyway, so the argument against doing this is that it would accelerate the shift to electric cars, but there aren't really enough electric cars for people to buy. So if you did it, so you might as well leave it and not hit people up in the pocket again. But we are reaching the point where the Chancellor, whoever is Chancellor, and the people at the Treasury are having to think up ways of how they're going to start replacing some of this money in the future as more people shift to electric and less people use petrol and diesel.
Yes, indeed. Helen, we had an interesting chat in the newsroom about how much does a packet of cigarettes cost nowadays after the hike that will take them up by £1.75. For anyone who doesn't smoke, for anyone who does smoke, of course, you know how much it costs. But my goodness, what is it, over £20 they were saying? So that's obviously going up. But good news for draft pint drinkers.
Well, sort of good news. So actually bad news for wine drinkers or people that drink at home. So taxes on alcohol are going to go up in line with retail price index inflation from August. But there's also this new regime where drinks are going to be taxed based on their alcohol content. This is actually announced back in 2021, but it's been pushed back for a while. It's now coming in 2023, August of this year. The Wine and Spirits Trade Association has said this is the biggest tax increase on wine in the past 50 years. So very, very bad news, people drinking wine at home. However, the government also announced, I think it was a Brexit pub bonanza or something. I can't remember the exact wording was, but they've said that basically people drinking draft pints in pubs, the duty on those draft drinks in pubs will be up to 11 pence lower than if you'd bought the same drink in a supermarket. However, are pubs actually going to pass on that tax saving to drinkers? I mean, I would imagine probably not, because pubs are still really struggling from things like energy bills going up. I think there is very little chance that that's going to be passed on. I don't think we're going to be seeing 11p off the price of a pint in a pub, sadly.
Yeah, I spoke to someone who was quite high up in the industry, as it were, who sort of raised eyebrows, gave it a smirk when I suggested, oh, are you going to pass that on? That's a no then, Simon.
Are you telling me that the Brexit pubs guarantee doesn't guarantee that your pint will be 11p cheaper? And if it isn't 11p cheaper, you can claim your money back directly from Jeremy Hunt.
I think that's not what they're saying. No, absolutely.
Man, I totally misunderstood this bit of the budget. Damn it.
Yeah, afraid not. Just one question before we get to the sort of financial backdrop to which the budget was delivered. Will the ISA limit finally rise from 20,000? Helen, you got an article on your website here, the budget small print hints it could go up with inflation and we may see more premium bond rate hikes.
Yeah, exactly. This is really interesting, actually. So I don't know if people know what journalists do immediately after the budget comes out. So the Treasury releases all the documents on its website and journalists will furiously control F search the documents for words that might relate to things that they want to write about, kind of to try and see whether anything's been buried in there that might not have been announced in the speech. So we did a bit of that in the office, and we uncovered an interesting thing in the costings document, which is basically all the policies that the Treasury has looked at. They've worked out how much it would cost for them to implement these policies over the next couple of years. So the ISA limit was frozen. That was something that was announced in the budget. It's frozen at £20,000, which is where it's been for quite some time. But in this document, the Treasury has looked at how much it would cost to start putting the £20,000 tax-free limit up with inflation from 2024-25. So that's quite interesting. The ISA limit hasn't moved since, I think, 2017. So if it did start going with inflation, you know, that could be a little boost. So we calculated that if this increase, you know, it's not definitely going to happen, but if they calculated it on the same formula as, say, the pension triple lock, that would mean the ISA allowance would go up by 4%, which would mean essentially an extra £800 in a year that you could stick into your ISA tax-free. So we don't know whether they're going to do it. The Treasury wouldn't confirm to us whether that was something they were definitely going to do or something they just looked at. But that would be a piece of welcome good news for savers, I think, if that did happen. I mean, worth saying that by the time that comes around, inflation will probably be much lower than it is now. But, you know, can't hurt to raise the limit a little bit.
All right, then. Finally, Simon, the Chancellor was delivering his budget against the backdrop of a full-scale global banking meltdown caused by the bond market, something his predecessor, well, knows a little bit about too. Simon, it would be remiss of us not to talk about what's been going on around the world. What has been going on? I mean, the Chancellor himself has been very sort of knees deep into it at the weekend before he delivered the budget. What's been going on?
Now, you know that line that we often give about, you know, banks now, they're in a much better position than they were during the financial crisis. Their balance sheets are much stronger. The banking system is actually pretty robust now. Just to be clear, when we said that, we didn't mean all banks. There was some of them. There was a little asterisk at the end of that sentence. Not all banks may be covered by this sentence. Some banks may go bust and need bailing out. Yes. So a bit of a domino effect going on. Who would have thought, hey, that the US tech firm and crypto bonanza might lead to some banks losing some money, particularly those largely focused on that kind of stuff. I mean, who would have thunk it? So basically, there's been a bit of a problem over in the US. Three regional US banks, Silicon Valley Bank, have a guess at what that does, Silvergate, San Francisco based, there you go, and Signature Bank, all found themselves in a bit of trouble. And this has led to effectively a bailout. I mean, the US government has said it will stand behind all banking deposits, which is pretty big. There was a, this kicked off with Silicon Valley Bank last Friday, where this is also related to problems in the government bond market, of all things, where some of these banks had large holdings of government bonds, and then they discovered that when they went to sell those government bonds, they weren't worth as much money as they paid for them, which caused them problems because they needed to raise funding, which is why they were selling some of their safest assets. And so it triggered this sort of mini run on Silicon Valley Bank, which is why the US government decided to step in, which is why Jeremy Hunt got involved over the weekend, which is why HSBC stepped in and bought the UK arm of Silicon Valley Bank, which is actually quite a big lender in terms of tech firms and things like that. They're all bank, it's their sort of bank of choice. You've also got Credit Suisse, which Credit Suisse definitely qualified for that asterisk on the banks are in a much better position than they were in the financial crisis line. Credit Suisse is an absolute basket case. If you start reading into the recent history of Credit Suisse, my wife said to me the other day, she was like, I mean, why would any investor ever have given this bank any money? And I was like, yeah, no, you're right. But you'll always find investors who'll give someone some money, but you'll often find that they have a tendency to run for the door at some point. So yeah, Credit Suisse, that has basically had to go cap in hand to the Swiss National Bank. That's getting a £45 billion bailout. And this has obviously had an effect on the general banking system. So arguably, your stalwart of the British high street and British mortgage lending scene, Lloyds Banking Group, probably has very little to do with this kind of stuff. But people worry about contagion. The financial crisis is still relatively fresh in people's minds, so they do worry about that kind of thing. I'm not going to make any kind of dangerous comment like this isn't a rerun of the financial crisis, because what I don't want to do is trigger another financial crisis due to Sod's Law. But I mean, I'm just going to stop talking now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
That's done. Me done. Done. Look. The thing to remember, actually, in all of this, whenever you read a story about a bank in trouble, is under the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, your savings in any individually licensed UK bank are protected up to £85,000 per individual. If you're a couple, you've got a joint account, you can double that. Any money above that is not protected. Now, you could probably decide, based on your own attitude to risk and all that kind of stuff, that the government's probably going to step in and not allow to go to your bank to go bust or whatever. But just make sure you stick below that 85,000. Be careful. That's the thing to take away from this, is there is protection in place. Do stick by those rules and you should be protected.
Marvellous. Thank you very much, Simon. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.